There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, so glad that you could join us here on this podcast. And normally, classic cardboard conversation can be held here at the table of Wax Ecstatic. But this episode, we're going to go a little bit off course here on purpose, as we are not talking about classic cardboard this time around. No, just in time for Thanksgiving in America, we've got some turkeys. And I mean some big turkeys. As we will be discussing a little bit about some random packs that I had in storage for a while. 1990 Donruss had a couple of wax packs there. 1989 Bowman had a rack pack that I've had in storage for a little while. And a couple of non-sports cards. I'm not going to spend too much time on these, but I figured it just kind of fit into the theme. We had a pack of Topps Desert Storm Victory Series cards from 1991. This was when the Gulf War, first Gulf War, was in its enduring freedom operation status. And as I will discuss, the cards that we pulled from that pack were as exciting as an enduring freedom operation sounds like. And also Pro Set Music Star cards. And again, I'm not going to lend too much time to that, but I do have a funny story about one of the performers that was in that pack. And if you're wondering about some of those cards, you can check out the video. We posted it yesterday on our Twitter time feed at Wax and Gum Stains. But if you go to YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic Thanksgiving Turkey Cards, you will see the unveiling of the 90 Donruss, 89 Bowman, 91 Topps Desert Storm cards, and the 91 Pro Set Music cards. And you'll see exactly who I'm talking about. But we'll talk about him in just a little bit. Now, this particular podcast, we're going to have a lot of fun with. It's going to be a slightly different from past shows, and that's okay. I like to shake it up just a little bit. And if you listen to our last program a couple of weeks ago, when we were talking about the 91 Leaf Studio and 92 Leaf sets, you heard me come up with this idea on the spot. Yes, this is when the whiteboard in my head slips out of my mouth. It happens sometimes. Sometimes it's good creativity. Other times it's a little messy. It gets me in trouble. But I'm very happy to be able to come up with some great ideas off the cuff. And this was definitely one of them. Not all great ideas that come out of my mouth turn out to be executed in a great fashion, but I certainly think this will. As it is coming up on the American Thanksgiving weekend, a Thanksgiving that is like no other, certainly in our lifetimes, I think you can, much like everything else that's going on with the COVID pandemic, you can trace back similar situations to the 1918 influenza. And certainly a Thanksgiving that has so many restrictions and barriers, you're probably going back to World War II, when Americans had to kind of cut back and hold off on a tradition like Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday. It really is. And especially as I've grown older, mostly because Christmas by now, you see why your parents dreaded Christmas, because when you're an adult and when you have kids, you realize, oh crap, I got to buy all these presents, and you're trying not to blow your budget all in, you know, one afternoon at Walmart. But, you know, as I've gotten older, Thanksgiving's become my favorite because in a normal Thanksgiving, you've got the Thanksgiving parade, which my wife and I and kids, we still watch it. We all get excited when Santa comes on the TV at 11:57 a.m. Eastern Time, parading right past the Macy's storefront in Manhattan. And after that, you've got a whole afternoon and evening of football. There's a lot of eating, a little drinking, a lot of fun with family. And that's why I enjoy Thanksgiving so much. But obviously this year, it's different. And because this is such an unusual Thanksgiving, I thought we'd have a slightly unusual show in focusing on the turkeys that have come through not only my collection, but also we opened it up from the Twitter handle at Wax and Gumstains, asked, what are your turkeys? And we had a very spirited conversation through many of our listeners about the turkeys in their collection. And, you know, you had the normal turkeys that came out, including 88 Donruss, 91 Fleer, also 90 Donruss, as we mentioned, is kind of in the spotlight with this program this week. But also 91 Score. There have been plenty of others. And there's even another conversation like who had the better set in 1985 or 86. And like I said, very spirited, very detailed, very passionate discussion going on at Wax and Gumstain. So you can check that out at your convenience. But certainly throughout the junk wax era, but I think you can go up and down the scope of baseball cards, really since 1981 when Fleer and Donruss came on the scene, you can pick out some turkeys. And we definitely have some that we got into detail with by opening packs, but also there are plenty more that we'll discuss. And also why, you know, there's a little bit of a lovable loser feeling with the turkey cards. Or as I said in the video, there may be some of these quote unquote turkey cards that are not turkeys, but there's some redeeming quality about them. And I like an 89 Bowman, which I'm somewhat of a reluctant fan about. Maybe it's because of my love for the Mr. Goodbar chocolate bar. I'm one of the few weirdos that actually eats those in the Hershey's mini bag. But you know, I see the 89 Bowman as the canned cranberry sauce of the Thanksgiving meal. You know, not the real cranberry. And I prefer the real cranberry. There's just something about the acidity and the sweetness and just this, you know, goopy pile of mushed cranberries. It just goes so good with everything else on your plate. But, you know, the canned cranberry, the processed cranberry, the gelatinous cranberry, it's not as quote unquote real as, you know, the whole cranberry, but you still get a little bit of it, don't you? You take a little slice of it. And really the favorite part of the canned cranberry, you know this, you open the can and you shake it a little bit and it starts jiggling and it starts coming out of the can and it makes that sound. You know that sound. And then it just kind of pours out into the bowl or onto the plate that you have, and you slice it up into little discs. That's kind of like what 89 Bowman is, and I'll explain more when we get a little further into this podcast. And there are some cards that you know, fans are going to call, or you know, hobby purists I should say, are going to call turkey cards or a waste of time. But I think we've all experienced this, and I've talked about this a lot on the podcast. There is a little bit of emotional value attached to some of these cards where the vast majority of the population will go, well, that's a crappy card, or that's a crappy set. But you've got that emotional value attached to it, and you still find a soft spot for some of those card sets that have been overlooked and have been thoroughly trashed over the years. Many of them from the junk wax era, because so many were made. But we'll talk about how even turkey cards need a little love. Yes, turkeys do need a little love every now and then. And now we're going down a very strange road here. So let me change the topic real quickly. We bring you Wax Ecstatic every other Friday here via our home base at Audio Boom. Also, everybody else who picks us up on the RSS feed, including Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, Spotify. We're everywhere, baby. And our next podcast scheduled to come your way December the 4th. And we will go ahead and try to put on a professional spin with that podcast once again, as we will be looking at the legendary 1963 Fleer set. This was Fleer's first direct, bold competition against Topps. They had toyed around with baseball cards in the late 1950s. Fleer had put out the Ted Williams set. They had also put out some baseball legends sets, basically featuring baseball players from the 20s and 30s and 40s in some cases, basically the players who were not under contract with Topps or Bowman prior to that. And in 1963, Fleer basically said, "Damn the torpedoes," and they started releasing a large base set to compete with Topps. But Topps and their lawyers very quickly threw the hammer down, and Fleer was told to cease and desist after putting out one series of their set. And the 63 Fleer series is actually a very impressive series, and it has come back in vogue in some of the throwback card designs. You know, Fleer still makes some cards, of course, not officially licensed, but you see the design crop up every now and then. And it's a very smart design. It's a very nice looking set. And thanks to some listeners who have sent in some of their own collection, some thoroughly beat up 63 Fleer cards, I've been able to put together a very small collection, a handful of cards that we will discuss in our next podcast. So that again is scheduled for December the 4th. That will be coming your way at noon Eastern. And of course, our video will be posted on YouTube the prior day, Thursday, December the 3rd. I'm also still in the process, I should say. I'm not making any progress, but I'm in the process of picking up some more cards for some future shows. Again, I still have an intention of looking at some of the early 90s Donruss cards that also kind of get lumped into the junk wax bucket. But you've got some pretty good products that came out in 92, 93, and 94. So we'll be doing that. And also, I've had some great suggestions, too, via the Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and also through emails as well. So I appreciate those suggestions. I'm looking through all of them, too, and just trying to, you know, sort out what makes sense, what would make a good show, or at least, you know, sometimes it's a situation of picking out one or two, you know, topics that I think will, you know, go together in a good theme for a show. So I always appreciate the feedback that we get through Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, but also again, through any emails that you send me. And you can email any questions or, you know, show suggestions if you wish. MattSammonSays@gmail.com. That's MattSammonSez at gmail.com. And you can also send in or talk about, try to arrange a cardboard donation if you prefer for the program. Always willing to listen to you if you're looking to unload some cards and have me either discuss them on the show, or you just feel like you want to send me some you know, cards just for my own personal collection. That is personally perfectly fine. So you can do that via the email or again, at Wax and Gum Stains, we're always open 24/7, talking cards and this, that, and the other. So looking forward to your commentary and your suggestions as well for the program. Now, we also take cash donations. If you do have a few bucks, you haven't blown it all at Walmart yet on your early Christmas shopping, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. And every dollar that you donate to Wax Ecstatic goes right back into the show. One, the maintenance of our feed via Audio Boom, and also keeping our archives. We've got over 170 episodes from the past 4+ years we've been doing this. So we keep those archives free, so you can go back and listen to some of the older shows if you wish. But it's also helpful in helping us get us the products that we're going to talk about. So if you're suggesting a particular product, if I don't have it handy, I got to go out and buy it. And, you know, we open it up and we talk about it. So that's another way that the money goes a long way. Plus, any excess product goes to our friends at Commons for Kids. Always helpful, or always glad to help out with Commons for Kids, who will take common cards, not just sports, but non-sports cards too. Not just your junk wax era stuff. You know, go ahead, reach into some vintage stuff or some more current stuff. And send it off to Commons for Kids, who donate those cards to kids who are dealing with whatever issues are going on in their life. Maybe they're dealing with medical issues. Maybe they're in a bad home situation. Maybe their parents are dealing with a difficult financial situation, and times are just tough for these kids. Nothing brings a smile to kids' faces like a stack of baseball cards. And it helps them stay involved in the sport, helps them stay involved in the hobby, or even get involved in the hobby. And it's always great to be able to facilitate that. Trust me, my son's Little League team, I just gave them a bunch of packs of 2020 Tops update cards. And this is a team that won a whopping 2 games in our fall ball season. 2 of about, I think, 16 or 17 games we played. And, you know, it was a baptism by fire season. Trust me, I know. I was one of the coaches. It was equally frustrating for the coaches as it was for the kids. But nothing brings a smile to their face than a whole bunch of cards. So whether it's a pack of new cards or if it's a stack of older cards that you would like to donate that are in good condition, please go ahead and send them off to Commons for Kids like we do. And you can follow them on Twitter, Commons for Kids. And that's the number 4, by the way. All right, let's talk a little bit about these turkeys. And I don't want to get too detailed about the particular sets. I mean, we all know about 1990 Donruss, the size of the set and some of the star cards that are in there. And that's really the only redeeming thing about 90 Donruss, isn't it? You can get a Ken Griffey Jr. card in the 1990 Donruss set, a second year Griffey. You can also get some other young stars, you know, John Smoltz and Tom Glavine, and you know the bunch, the typical crew that you would find that got their starts in the late 80s. You can find some rookie cards or early career cards. You can also find some late career cards for bigger stars, the usual crew there as well. George Brett, Nolan Ryan, Robin Yount, you name it, Paul Molitor, Dale Murphy. Like I said, the names are pretty obvious there. But what makes 1990 Donruss such a turkey of a set? Well, you've got the obvious thing, and that is just the appearance of it. We've talked about aesthetics of cards, and especially when you're in a hobby or an industry, I guess you could say, where the marketplace is extremely oversaturated, you have to have a product that not just stands up to the test of time in quality, but just looks good. It has to be appealing. It has to grab the owner's eyes and then their hearts. And 1990 Donruss just did not do that, mostly because of the extremely bright ketchup red color to it. Not only did you have the red on it, but you had this kind of Jackson Pollock paint explosion, you know, in the side margins. So it's almost like the picture of the player was dropped on a can of paint or on a palette that had a whole bunch of colors, and it just kind of splattered everywhere, which is a little bit of the 1990 look. Remember some of the wild, vibrant colors in fashion and television. And, you know, 1990 was a very iris searing time in color. There was a lot of neon going on, a lot of pinks and purples and teals and you name it. And, you know, it certainly did represent the times, and that's something else that baseball cards are supposed to do. It's supposed to be representative of the era that they were produced and distributed. But even in 1990, it was looked at as like, This is kind of loud. And Donruss didn't help itself on the backs of the cards. They had the standard back design for Donruss, which they had been using at this point since 1985. And they had a, what would you call it from the Crayola box? Cyan, I believe, was the color, you know, kind of that burnt orange color. That was on the back. So if you're somebody who eats a bag of Cheetos and you've got that Cheeto powder all over your fingers and you like it so much, you don't eat it, you just kind of look at it on your fingers and then you eat it, of course, then 1990 Donruss is for you, because it looks like the whole set was just dropped in a vat of the powdery stuff that ends up on Cheetos or original nacho cheese, Doritos. You kind of get the picture there. It is just a little too bright, a little too loud, a little bit tacky. And by 1990 standards, if it was too tacky, it was incredibly tacky. Again, just look back at some of the trends that were going on in pop culture back in 1990. And you compare 90 Donruss to some of the other sets, 1990 Tops is also, at least on the front, very representative of the time, kind of had a sharp MTV feel to it, but not quite as gaudy as Donruss. Fleer had a very basic classic design. Bowman had a very muted design by necessity, since the 89 set was such a failure. And then, of course, you had Score with a very 1990-ish look, a very MTV look there, while Upper Deck was still raising the bar after its premiere edition in 1989, a very, very sharp set in 1990. So you have sharp in Upper Deck, you have classic in Fleer, you have simple in Bowman, you've got popular looking but not gaudy in Tops and Score. So that just kind of pushes Donruss down near the bottom of the pack. A lot of people will put Bowman at the bottom, and I can't argue with that. 90 Bowman, even though I have a soft spot for that set as well, is not extremely pleasing to look at. It is a very boring set. So Donruss, from the very beginning, just kind of got pushed down to the bottom. And then the fact that, again, this was just in the thickest years of the gluttony of baseball card production, there were millions of each card produced from each set, and there are still quite a bit out there. Now, there is still some emotional value that you could tie to a 1990 Donruss set. For me personally, I remember 1990 really being the first full year that I just totally, enveloped myself in baseball cards. I collected every card that I could find, and not just from 1990, but that's when I started reaching back into the mid to late 80s a little bit, trying to catch up on all that I missed since I didn't really get started until 1989. So 1990, I recall in my Easter basket that year, there was a pack of Donruss baseball cards, and it was kind of neat. And, you know, I remember still even 2 or 3 years later going to a card shop, and because there were so many 90 Donruss cards produced, I could buy a cello box of 90 Donruss for like $10 back then. And it was just fun to open up the packs and try to put together the set. I never completed it. And of course, when I did my purge of cards about 20 years ago, the 90 Donruss did not stay. I took the 5 or 6 star cards, the cards that were worth slightly more than 20 cents, and, you know, put them in a folder, and that was about that. So that's how things worked out with Donruss and me in 1990. So even though it's a crappy set where there's too much of it made, it's understandable how you could have a little bit of an emotional attachment to it. And I think you can have that with a lot of cards that some people call turkeys. 88 Donruss, again, the redheaded stepchild of the junk wax era. I've always kind of liked 88 Donruss. And maybe it's because I like the Olin Mills studio backdrop that they have in there. You know, we all had those elementary school pictures with that similar backdrop as 88 Donruss, right? And I know 89 Donruss, which I think is just a criminally underrated set and totally gets thrown into the junk wax era bucket, I thought 89 Donruss was a great set, not only because they were smart enough to include Ken Griffey Jr. in the bass set, but also, you know, it has this sharp, you know, very modern, crisp look to it. And I know a lot of our listeners actually have emotional connections to 89 Donruss for whatever reason. You know, everyone's reason is a little different. But I just find it amazing that, you know, even the turkey sets, you can find something good about that set to where even if you open a pack now, you still at least kind of enjoy the process of opening it up. And yeah, opening a 90 Donruss pack today is not quite as thrilling as opening, say, I don't know, a 75 Tops pack, you know, something that's a little rare, has a little bit of mystery to it, a little bit of excitement. You know, you open a 75 Tops pack and go, hey, I can get Brett's rookie, I can get Yount's rookie, you know, maybe I can find a Pete Rose or Mike Schmidt or whatever. 90 Donruss, you're going, all right, yeah, if I don't get Griffey, then this is just going in the trash. So, you know, there's not quite the same excitement of opening some of those turkey packs, but there's still the thrill of opening the pack, which I think makes it all the worthwhile. So, hey, I didn't spend anything on these Donruss packs. Somehow they found their way to me. So I'll open them. I'll look at them. I'll send them off to Commons for Kids. Hopefully they can make use of them. And that's about that. You know, it's a turkey set that some people may have an emotional attachment to. I have a tiny bit only because there are some childhood memories. But in the grand scheme of things, it's one of those sets that you can pretty much forget as the years go by. 89 Bowman, the exact same. And we've talked a lot about Bowman over the last year, especially when we did a few months ago a look at the turning of the corner for Bowman, 91, 92, 93, when they, you know, became this kind of, you know, scramble to rethink what Bowman was supposed to be since the 89 set fell so flat. Having it, you know, kind of re-envisioned and you know, reposition as the rookie card set. That was something that took time, but when it did finally grab on for Bowman, boy, it really took off. And we talked a little bit about the 89 set, which the biggest complaint is, you know, in Topps' attempt to recreate the 53 Bowman set, which people will tell you is arguably the best baseball set ever completed. In fact, the Pee Wee Reese card, where Reese is in midair, you know, in a double play fashion, is often cited as, if not the greatest baseball card made, perhaps top five, top 10, definitely. So you understand where Topps with the Bowman brand was trying to come from. They were trying to counter some of the more flashy new products. You know, you have to think too, like mid-80s, you had Sports Flix come around. And Sports Flix was, it was a bit schlocky. You know, it was the magic motion. Ooh, if I move the card up and down, the player is, you know, in his pitching motion or he's swinging the bat. You know, it was kind of like cereal box toy kind of stuff. And you could see what Topps was trying to do. Okay, let's get away from the kitschy and let's kind of do the throwback set here. And we've mentioned before that Topps' big sets were kind of the prelude to that, where the Topps' big set of 1988 was a modern nod to the 56 Topps sets, which are also arguably one of the best that were ever created. So you see what Topps was trying to do, and it makes a lot of sense. But because collectors were so enraptured with the, you know, the premium sets that were starting to come out, and of course, rookie card chases and everything else, and of course, they were set in their ways. You know, why do I need to buy boxes and plastic pages that fit 89 Bowman when all the other cards I buy and all the other cards I've bought since 1957 fit this particular size? Why do I need to change? So 89 Bowman was seen as a failure. And as I mentioned, the 1990 set, the card reverted back to normal baseball card size. It was kind of a muted presentation. But you know, it was a good effort by Topps to do something different and unique and throwback-ish with the 89 set. It was supposed to mimic the 1953 set. And in many ways, it did that. It was a very simple design. You just had the player autograph on the front. And I've always loved the back of the Bowman cards from this era, where they did the splits, where it wasn't just the stats from the previous season, it was the stats broken down team by team, which now you can't do because teams play interleague now. You don't have enough room for 14 or 16 teams on the back. You'd have to find space for 20, and then you'd need a magnifying glass to read that. But I always liked kind of the pre-sabermetric look at the stats on the back. I thought it was innovative. I know a lot of collectors don't like it, but that's just my opinion. And 89 Bowman, as I mentioned, is kind of the canned cranberry sauce that we have at Thanksgiving. The real cranberries, the whole cranberries, the ones that actually look like cranberries, that's the one you prefer because it looks, it feels, it tastes, it smells like cranberry. Where, you know, the canned cranberry, it's the noise when it comes tumbling out of the can. That's the big appeal there. And then the fact that you just kind of have this gelatinous glob on your plate next to the beauty of the turkey and the ham and the stuffing and the sweet potatoes makes the contrast of the canned cranberry so much more interesting. And I think 89 Bowman really is that set, not just in 1989, but kind of, you know, pull it back a little bit. Look at all the other sets of the late 80s and early 90s, the junk wax era. It is the canned cranberry. You may look at 89 Upper Deck and then, you know, let's put some of the other more favorite sets out there. What, 91 Tops? 91 Top Stadium Club. I know a lot of collectors still like the look of 92 Fleer, even if there's not a lot of value in those cards. You also have 87 Tops, 88 Tops. You can pull together, you know, seven or eight favorite sets from that era, and then you just drop 89 Bowman next to it. And you bet it's just one of those sets that just kind of, you look at it and it goes, because it just looks totally out of place from everything else that is on that plate of baseball cards. So while I have a soft spot for 89 Bowman, I completely understand why you may not. But I always like thinking of 89 Bowman as that canned cranberry sauce of the numerous baseball cards that we may have on our plate, so to speak. Now, 89 Bowman is one of those sets, and I will put it there with 90 Fleer. Think of another set. Maybe 90 Bowman. Not too many others from that era. Where if I was at a card show and somebody was selling a factory 89 Bowman set for $5 or $8, one day I may actually just buy it. Why not? You know? I have no interest in, you know, buying boxes and boxes and packs of these cards to try to hand collate a set. But it's just one of those sets where, and again, this is the Mr. Goodbar equation coming in here. You just kind of feel sorry about it. You know, everybody hates the stray dog of 89 Bowman. And, you know, if you can get a good deal on a factory set, sealed factory set, maybe you just buy it for the hell of it and just to put it in the back of your collection, you know, away from all the good cards. Kind of hide it from everybody else, I guess you can say. So those are my thoughts on 89 Bowman. I've expressed them many times before. I know a lot of people see it as a turkey. I see it as more of the canned cranberry sauce. Different and certainly not up to the real cranberry, but you still have that guilty pleasure of at least looking at it, right? Now, as for the non-sports cards, real quickly, I opened up, and again, these two packs came from a variety pack that I ordered about a year ago. We did a show on a variety pack, and it was not a very good variety pack, and it was a mixture of sports and non-sports, and I basically panned the variety pack. Sometimes those variety packs that you do get on eBay are fun. You know, they're kind of neat. And I actually experienced that with my son buying them for me for, you know, my birthday or Father's Day. And you know you're not going to get anything of value out of these packs, but it's kind of neat and it's a sentimental gift too. You know, these are the only Junk Wax era cards, you know, that I'll set aside in a box because I see it as a Father's Day gift and it's kind of neat. But, you know, this one particular variety pack that I ordered just had some incredibly crappy cards too, especially on the non-sports side. So two of the non-sports packs were the Music Stars Pro Set 1991 set, which we'll get to in a minute, and then the Topps Desert Storm cards. And I think you may remember these real well because the you know, invasion of Kuwait by the Iraqis in the summer of 1990, boy, that put everybody on edge. And troops are going over there and people are thinking this is World War III. And boy, there was just a lot of anxiety. And then the fact, too, that you know, the military procedures were going on, you know, throughout the holiday season in 1990 and 91, you know, that was very stressful. This was, you know, the first major military involvement that the United States had since Vietnam. And, you know, by 1990, Vietnam was still very, very fresh in the minds of a lot of American citizens. So there was a lot of concern going into this, and rightly so. And getting into the propaganda of the war was Topps and also Pro Set. They put out some, you know, military featured cards. And I remember buying a pack or two back in the day of both. And I remember the Pro Set cards were a little different in that they featured more personalities. Like there was a Dick Cheney card. I mean, who wouldn't want a Dick Cheney card, right? And, you know, George H.W. Bush, Colin Powell, and H. Norman Schwarzkopf. I mean, that guy was a celebrity because of the war over in the Middle East at that time. So it was kind of neat to go, oh, well, yeah, I've got a Colin Powell card or a Schwarzkopf card. And it was a neat little time capsule collectible, but really nothing more to it. Like every other card that was produced back then, it was overproduced. Well, the one pack that we had in this recent variety pack was not just Desert Storm, but it was called the Victory Series. So this is before they changed Desert Storm to Desert Shield. But this was Operation Enduring Freedom. So the Iraqis were repelled from Kuwait. The Americans and the coalition forces had settled things down in Kuwait, and now it was more just monitoring what the Iraqis were doing, you know, with Saddam Hussein over the next several years. And you can tell by the cards that are in this pack that there was just absolutely nothing to be said about the current situation in the Middle East. And the entire pack is nothing but pictures of airplanes and missile launchers and a free sticker. I got a sticker of the Kuwaiti flag, which, okay, I'm not even sure how valuable that was in 1990. But, you know, if you've ever wanted a Kuwaiti flag sticker, then, you know, the Topps Desert Storm cards are the way to go. And it really just falls flat. And I think it's just a great symbol of just how by 1991, anything that could be turned into a collectible card was. And I've often joked that even dog food had collectible cards. And I still have my Will Clark dog card from 1993 from some brand of dog food. And, you know, it was just getting ridiculous at this point in time. But, you know, that's because the hobby was getting ridiculous, too. Anything that could be turned into a card was. And because the hobby was just so bloated then, there was a price tag attached to everything. So if you had a George H.W. Bush card, there was a value of a couple dollars put on that card because he was the president and his approval ratings were through the roof at that time. And it's just kind of silly when you look back at some of these cards that were put out. Not because, you know, there was extreme value to them. It's just that there was some perceived value and collectors often overpaid for that perceived value. Likewise, the Pro Set Music Stars card, I will say there was some interesting variety in these cards in that you had some legendary acts in here. In this one pack I had, you had Kiss, you had Jefferson Airplane, And, you know, Hall & Oates, which is interesting because Daryl Hall, I remember, had a hit song in 1991 or 92. But the card that was next to Hall & Oates in this pack is MC Hammer. And that's just the state of top 40 slash adult contemporary music. In 1991, you could hear Daryl Hall's new song followed by MC Hammer's Too Legit to Quit. So it's just kind of, again, that bizarro life that we lived in 1990, 1991, where everything was just clashing and it wasn't just colors and hairstyles. But I do have to mention one funny story about one of the cards, and then we'll talk about the stories of four random players that we selected from the packs. But in the Music Stars pack, I pulled what would have been the Jose Canseco of a 1991 pack of baseball cards. Let me stand corrected, because this guy wasn't the Jose Canseco. You know, Canseco at least had several years of good production with or without the assistance of steroids. Nah, this guy was the, I don't even want to call him Mo Vaughn, because I think that's an insult to Mo Vaughn. The Kevin Moss of music cards, I think so, and that's with all due respect to Kevin Moss, who we talked about in the last program. You know, he's a respected financial advisor now. But if there was anybody who career-wise could be lined up much like Kevin Moss, it's got to be Vanilla Ice. So yes, I pulled a Vanilla Ice card. Vanilla Ice, aka Robbie Van Winkle, definitely the Kevin Moss of pop music. While Kevin Moss had one spectacular year in 1991, certainly Vanilla Ice did too. Ice Ice Baby, his biggest hit. He also had a pretty popular cover of the Wild Cherry song, Play That Funky Music. And he was in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie that was released around that time. Vanilla Ice had a year in 1991. And you know the story of Vanilla Ice, of course. You know, the PR story of how he was a gangster, that fell apart pretty quickly. He got into a tiff with the rock band Queen because he had sampled the bass line from Under Pressure for Ice Ice Baby. And, you know, he tried to argue that, no, it was an original riff, or, you know, the way that they looped it, it made it different than, you know, what you heard in the Queen song. And of course, that wasn't the case. It was your typical rap sampling, which all rappers do. And, you know, he tried to make it something of his own, and it definitely was not. And then you had, and by the way, you know, John Deacon needs all the credit for that beat from Under Pressure, or that riff, I should say. But the thing is, of course, you know, on top of just Vanilla Ice falling apart with his story and a lot of quote unquote serious rappers at the same time, you know, you had NWA, you had gangster rap starting to come up, you know, through the underground. You know, they're kind of laughing this goofy white guy with the pompadour away. And so, you know, Vanilla Ice pretty much goes the way of the dodo by 1993. And you've got alternative rock music that's coming in and becoming popular then. And pop music kind of goes through a change at that time. So Vanilla Ice tries to reinvent himself kind of as this, you know, Rasta guy around 94, 95, totally falls flat. And then fast forward to, I believe it would have been the fall of 1998, summer or fall of 1998. Maybe it was 1999. It was around there, 98, 99. All I remember is I was a senior in college. And working at the college rock station, we got word that Vanilla Ice was releasing a hard rock album. And clearly just taking advantage of what the music scene was becoming then. This was the early days of Limp Bizkit and Korn. And you name it, you know, all of those harder bands, those really angry rock bands from about 20 years ago, that was becoming in vogue at that time. And we were delighted to find out that one of the cuts on his new album was a rock remix of Ice Ice Baby. And I remember listening to it thinking, this isn't half bad. And it was actually kind of a cult classic on our college radio station, WVUA, New Rock 90.7 in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And, you know, it kind of permeated throughout the community. And there's a simple reason why. Because while Ice Ice Baby in 1999, the original version of it was kind of a joke, something that you laughed at, something where you went, oh, well, you know, I was 13 years old. I listened to a lot of stupid music then. Well, Ice Ice Baby, the rock version, was, you know, kind of the, you know, the modern song that I think people were looking for, where you took that silly joke, gave it a contemporary spin through the rock cycle, and it sounded pretty good, actually. So the song you laughed at when you listened to it 13, you know, now you're 21, 22, you're banging your head to it. It was actually quite fun. And we find out that Vanilla Ice is going to be playing at a club. I'm trying to remember which club it was. Was it Egan's? I don't remember. It was one of the old clubs on the strip on University Boulevard. And we find out that he's going to be performing there, and we're just in heaven. So naturally, we find a way to book him. We interview him on the student radio station. Have to admit, he was kind of a nice guy. Now, he's also been involved in a lot of domestic cases at his home, so I can't say for certain he is a quote-unquote nice guy, but with my interaction with him, he was a pleasant person. Signed a station bumper sticker for me. I still have it somewhere, oh, by the way. And I remember, and follow me on this, I know this is kind of a long story here, but I remember going to the concert, because I had to, because I worked at the radio station, and he comes out and he does two or three songs from his new album. And, you know, there's probably about 200 people or so in this little bar, just kind of hopping up and down and bashing their heads. And then he goes, oh, yeah, and you hear dun, 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 dun. Everybody, ah, you know, everyone's going crazy. Oh, it's the new Ice Ice Baby. So he sings the Ice Ice Baby. The place is just going ape over this. The song ends. Everybody's clapping and cheering. Ah. He starts his next song, and I kid you not, everybody leaves that room. Everybody, with the exception of, you know, the seven or eight of us from the student radio station who had to be there. I have never in my life seen a room clear so quickly. Then that night in a little bar in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, when Vanilla Ice finished his new version of Ice Ice Baby and tried to move on to some other new material. That is, I've never seen a room clear so quickly for a non-emergency reason. I mean, seriously, all the people left there as if somebody went, oh, the fire alarm went off. Quick, let's go. It was just hilarious. And this is over 20 years later. I still laugh at it because this guy, I've never seen a room clear so quickly ever in my life. It was just absolutely amazing. So there's my story of the Kevin Moss of pop music in 1991. Yes, Robert Van Winkle, also known as Vanilla Ice. All right, let's talk about some players and some personalities you might actually care about. Some former ball players. I picked four cards, two from the Donruss packs, two from the Bowman rack pack. And I've got some amazing stories here. We always seem to pull out some amazing stories with these players. But you're going to find some interesting side stories with some of these players. And we talk about turkey sets. There's a couple of turkey trades involved in here. And you'll see what I'm talking about here in just a moment. Let's start off from the 1990 Donruss set. Rick Cerrone, birth name Richard Aldo Cerrone from Newark, New Jersey, who had a very lengthy and productive career, not necessarily known for his hitting, but he was a defensive stalwart behind the plate for numerous teams for 18 seasons in the big leagues. And Rick Cerrone, like I said, born in Newark, New Jersey, I should say, played high school and football at Essex Catholic High School and then attended Seton Hall, where he played baseball there for 4 years. Cleveland Indians come knocking, picking him 7th overall in the 1975 MLB draft. Makes his MLB debut in August of 1975. Now, remember, he had played college, so the Indians very quickly just throw him into action just a few weeks after they sign him. And his first action was actually pinch hitting for Boog Powell. Remember Boog Powell finishing up his career in Cleveland? I remember Boog Powell looking like a giant red hot in those gaudy red Indians uniforms of the mid to late 70s. But anyways, Rick Cerrone pinch hits for Boog Powell and gets a few games of experience in 1975 with Cleveland. Same thing in 1976, just a cup of coffee. And on December 6th, 1976, he gets traded to the expansion Toronto Blue Jays, along with the popular John Lowenstein, for Rico Carty. Now, we've talked about John Lowenstein before. He actually got traded back to the Indians. The Indians realized that they didn't really want to part with him, so they made another trade for him. So Cerrone, who was getting just a little cup of coffee here and there with the Indians, decides to make a bit of a home in Toronto with this really terrible team. He is the catcher of record in the Blue Jays' first game, that snowy day, April 7th, 1977, at the X in Toronto against the Chicago White Sox. He would hit his first career home run off of Texas' Nelson Briles in August of 1977. Played only 31 games with the Jays, but again, part of that inaugural team. And he would get a little more playing time in 1978 as the Blue Jays were starting to part ways with Alan Ashby at that time. And by 1979, he was pretty much the number one catcher for the Jays. Now, the Jays, of course, bottoming out in 1979 as they're building up a young and exciting team. So they start to jettison players, make some moves for some guys who are going to play a little more integral part in the growth of the team. So after the 1979 season, he's traded to the Yankees, along with Tom Underwood and Ted Wilborn, for Chris Chambliss, Paul Mirabella, and Domiso Garcia. So he joins the Yankees in 1980. And has some very tough shoes to fill because, of course, Thurman Munson passing away the previous August. So there's a lot of expectations on Cerrone, but he delivers in 1980, hitting .277 in 147 games. Actually finished 7th in American League MVP voting. Helps the Yankees win the division and get into the playoffs. And he also threw out 57 attempted stolen base attempts, which was the league best at 51.8%. And he also had a pretty good playoff series in 1980 against Kansas City, but the Royals would move on to the World Series. Now, he struggled a little bit in 1981, however, helps the Yankees throughout the 1981 playoffs. Struggles as the playoffs go on and really struggled in the World Series against the Dodgers, hitting only .190 in that six-game series loss, which the Yankees led 2-0. Now, in 1982, he starts splitting time behind the plate with numerous catchers, starting with Butch Weingar, and he is basically a backup for the Yankees for the next few years, appearing in a handful of games here and there, before getting traded in November 1984 to the Atlanta Braves for Brian Fisher. So he would split time with Bruce Eggs Benedict, got 96 games in 1985, gets traded again to Milwaukee for veteran Ted Simmons. In 1986, he and Charlie Moore split in the catching duties again. He's granted free agency. And heading into the 1987 season, he decides to rejoin the Yankees, which by then are once again a contending team. So he's splitting the duties again behind the plate with Joel Skinner. And before the 1988 season, the Yankees cut ties with him as they decided to go with a Joel Skinner and Don Slott combination. So he signs with the rival Boston Red Sox at the beginning of the season. Now, an interesting story here about Cerrone before he signed with the Red Sox, because he was cut so late by the Yankees, he wasn't really getting that much attention. He was actually cut April 4th, 1988. So you're right on the cusp at the beginning of the season and there's no interest. So he is actually considering becoming an advertising salesman for WABC Radio in New York. But again, the Red Sox give him the chance. He signs on, and it works out rather splendidly. As offensively, he's able to rebound. He's splitting duties with Rich Gedman, but the Red Sox end up winning the AL East division, and he did not appear in any of the postseason games against Oakland. 1989, production dips a little bit. However, the Red Sox come up short in the playoff chase with Toronto that year, and the Red Sox decide not to renew his contract. So where do you go after the Boston Red Sox release you and you're a soon-to-be 36-year-old journeyman catcher who is often platooning with another catcher? Well, you go back where you call home, and that would be the Yankees. Once again, he rejoins the Yankees third time, signs a two-year contract as a free agent, splits time with Bob Guerin behind the plate. Offensively did really well, but the Yankees, who at this time are going through another rebuilding stage, decide to release him after the 1990 season. So he goes cross town to the Mets in 1991, splits time with Charlie O'Brien behind the plate. Once again, granted free agency, decides to go across the border, heads up to Montreal, signs as a free agent with the Expos, backs up Gary Carter. And of course, you have Darren Fletcher at this time starting to come up through the system. So Cerrone didn't even make it throughout the entire season. He got released in July of 1992. Finishes his career with a .245 batting average, again, some pretty solid defensive numbers as well. Very dependable. That's why his career was so lengthy. You could always find a purpose for him with any team, and he was with some good teams along the way. Now, this Rick Cerrone should not be confused with a longtime public relations director with the Yankees. That was another Rick Cerrone. I believe his name, his last name had two R's in it. So there's often some confusion there because Rick Cerrone, the catcher, played there for three times. A lot of people thought that he moved into the front office. That was not the case. He did, however, spend a little more time with the Yankees after his playing career. He was a color analyst on Channel 11, WPIX, in 1996 and 1997. Also did some color commentary for the Baltimore Orioles and CBS Radio as well. He went back home to Newark, New Jersey, and founded the Newark Bears, a longtime independent Atlantic League team. And he sold the team in 2003. And he was recently inducted into the College Baseball Hall of Fame for his time at Seton Hall. Interesting footnote to Rick Cerrone's career. In 1981, he released a 7-inch single called A Long Run Home. That was a song that was recorded in Newington, Connecticut, from the point of view of a Newark baseball player visiting a New York stadium during a snowstorm. Now, the record sleeve noted that Cerrone's royalties would be donated to the Italian Earthquake Victims Fund, so certainly a noble cause there. Unfortunately, the song was not much of a hit, so whatever it generated, as little as it may be, at least went to a good cause. But unfortunately, as much as I have tried, I have not been able to find the Rick Cerrone A Long Run Home song online. I've looked everywhere. In fact, I'm going to look again right now real quick. A Long Run Home. I would like to think that there's some terrible YouTube video of it out here. No, unfortunately, it's not there. Yep, so it wasn't popular in 1981. It's still not popular now. If you can't find it on the internet, I don't know if it ever actually truly existed, right? Now, a former battery mate of Rick Cerrone for some of his tours of duty with the Yankees. Dave Rigetti, Rags, is our next card, another player that was pulled from the 1990 Donruss packs. And some interesting branches from the Dave Rigetti story here. This is another guy who had a very lengthy career as a starter and as a reliever. He appeared in 16 seasons in the big leagues. Born in San Jose, California, his father, Leo Rigetti, was a professional ball player, and boy, did he have an interesting story. So Leo Rigetti was a phenomenal baseball talent. He was spotted playing sandlot ball in San Jose. And a Yankees scout by the name of Joe Devine sees him. Leo Rigetti is a shortstop. And while he struggled at the plate, he was a pretty solid defensive player. So the Yankees thought, all right, well, maybe we can turn him into a pitcher. So he signs a $10,000 contract with the Yankees in 1944. He was one of the bonus babies, and he starts his career in Newark with the Newark Bears of the International League. Now, in 1946, he suffered this bizarre accident where he slipped and fell. He ended up cutting his right index finger, and that ended his pitching career. So the Yankees go, all right, well, let's put him back in as a shortstop, and he's, you know, playing throughout the minor leagues. He's really struggling, and he leaves the Yankee organization in 1950. He basically just gives up and thinks that baseball is not going to work out for him. Well, in spring training of 1952 with the Boston Braves, he was informed that he could play in the minor leagues. He tried out, couldn't make it with the major league team. So the Braves say, hey, we're going to send you to AAA. Well, Rigetti allegedly got angry at the Braves official who's telling him this message, and he threw a chair at this guy. And there's a lot of he said going on back and forth here, but in the end, the Braves basically go, okay, forget about it. You're not going to play for us ever again. And Rigetti would end up playing for the next few years with the Pacific Coast League. In fact, I see a picture of him online here. It looks like with the Seattle Rainiers. So a professional ball player, Leo Rigetti, who could have become a major league player had he cooled his heels just a little bit. But after his baseball days, he decided to work for his father's tallow business in San Jose. What is tallow, you wonder? It is a subject that is rendered from beef or mutton fat. That sounds pretty fun. Yeah, it's tallow is part of soap making, by the way, if you were wondering. If you're a soap enthusiast, you use that stuff. So that's how Mr. Rigetti would turn his career after failing to make it to the big leagues. So here is Dave Rigetti, son of Leo, brother of Steve Rigetti, who was also a talented baseball player. Because Leo couldn't make it as a baseball player, his sons played the game often, and they were both stars on the Lincoln Glen Little League team, while Dave was an outfielder and Steve was a shortstop. Now, while he's attending Pioneer High School in San Jose, a scout for the Texas Rangers by the name of Patty Cottrell is scouting him, and he suggested to Dave Rigetti that he become a pitcher because of his throwing motion. He had a pretty good arm and thought that he would do better going from the outfield to the pitcher's mound. Well, Rigetti would later enroll with San Jose City College, and one of his teammates was Dave Steeb, big fan of mine, or I'm a big fan of his. Maybe he's a big fan of mine. I don't know. Hey, Dave, hope you're enjoying the show. Anyways, Dave Steeb, who is also an outfielder at this time and who is also starting at this junior college, is also getting advice from Patty Cottrell. And Cottrell's telling Steeb the exact same thing he's telling Rigetti. Hey, you've got a good arm. You should be a pitcher. And Steve is stubborn, no surprise there, and he decides that he's going to stay in the outfield. That's how he's going to make it to the major leagues. He wants to be an outfielder, he wants to swing the bat, and that's what he's going to do. So for a brief time, Rigetti and Steve are teammates at San Jose City College. Rigetti pitching, Steve in the outfield. And Rigetti would actually be named the Junior College Player of the Year as a pitcher. And the interesting note here is while Rigetti would eventually get drafted by the Texas Rangers in 1977, Steve would go on to play at a higher level college in Illinois. And due to injuries on his baseball team, he got pushed into the pitching staff. And of course, the rest, as they say, is history, as he would become a pitcher starting in 1978. Well, Dave Rigetti not only gets drafted by the Texas Rangers, but the Rangers promise that they would take Steve Rigetti as well. And they did just that. Dave goes in the first round. Steve goes in the sixth round. And they would work their way up through the Texas Rangers organization in 1978. Now, after the 1978 season, Rigetti would get traded to the Yankees along with Juan Beniquez, Mike Griffin, Greg Jemison, and Paul Mirabella, in exchange for Sparky Lyle, Domingo Ramos, Mike Heath, Larry McCall, and Dave Rasich. Also, cash involved there is too, as Texas Rangers ownership always dubious with cash flow at that time. Now, the Yankees bring in Righetti, and they are setting the expectations unrealistically high. They're calling him the next Ron Guidry. Now, keep in mind, Ron Guidry's already there. Ron Guidry had a stellar season in 1978, had 25 wins, I believe. So they're already ordaining Righetti as the next one. So that's a little heady, isn't it? And also, later on in Righetti's career with the Yankees, Billy Martin would declare that Righetti was going to win 20 games in his next season. And Righetti had a little trouble, you know, realizing some of the potential that was being foisted upon him. Now, another interesting side note to the Righetti story, after he got traded to the Yankees, he was almost traded again to the Minnesota Twins. This is a great story from the United Press International Wire from back in January 1979. The Yankees were going to send Righetti, Juan Beniquez, Damaso Garcia, and Chris Chambliss to the Minnesota Twins for, are you ready for this? Rod Carew. Holy, what? Yeah, the Twins, who were always looking to dump a contract, we're going to send Rod Carew to the Yankees for Righetti, Chambliss, Beniquez, and Garcia. Now, some of those names that I mentioned there, Chambliss, Beniquez, and Garcia, does that sound familiar? Yeah, they were all part of the Rick Cerrone trade I was talking about before with the Blue Jays and the Yankees. Carew, of course, would eventually end up with the Angels, and that was just one of those deals that never happened. They were just unable to, get the final pieces together for that trade. Now, it worked out okay for Righetti as he would make his major league debut in September of 1979. Again, Billy Martin declaring that he was going to win 20 games in 1980. That was not the case. He actually went 6-10 and, had some trouble with his control, but he was able to make the Yankee team shortly after the start of the 1981 season, after he had some initial success in AAA. Comes up to the Yankee organization and wins the American League Rookie of the Year, beating out Rich Gedman and Bob Ojeda. This is in 1981, as I mentioned, and he was also part of that Yankee team that was able to make it to the World Series. Struggled as a starter in 1982. He was supposed to get sent to the minor leagues. George Steinbrenner wanted it that way, but management prevailed, being able to keep Righetti in New York and also looking at perhaps moving him into the bullpen. Now, Steinbrenner would eventually get his way as Righetti would go back to the minor leagues, and Righetti had to deal with anxiety issues. Again, remember what I said about the unbelievably high expectations that were set his way. And he would split the season going back and forth between New York and Columbus. Finally, it all comes together for him in 1983, legendary moment. July 4th, 1983, throws a no-hitter against the Boston Red Sox. Final out of the game, a strikeout against Wade Boggs. And then he would move into the Yankee bullpen, where he had a ton of success. He was an all-star as a reliever in 1986 and 1987. And he would actually become the first player in history to both pitch a no-hitter and also lead the league in saves in his career. Now, later on, Dennis Eckersley, and Derek Lowe would match that feat as well. But Righetti was the first to do that. Later on in his career with the Yankees, still struggling just a little bit, didn't like the direction that the Yankees were going in, so he becomes a free agent in 1987. Had a chance to sign a contract in Tokyo, also had offers from other teams, including the San Francisco Giants, but he opted to stay with the New York Yankees, signing a three-year contract there. And not only were the Yankees heading in the wrong direction, but as Righetti would find out very quickly, he was heading in the wrong direction too. He was not a fan favorite by Yankees fans for much of the 1990 season. And by 1991, he is able to finally leave the Yankees. He does sign with the San Francisco Giants, gets a four-year contract with them at the time. He would have a pretty successful season in 1991 as well as 1992. In fact, made a start in June of 1992, first time that he started a game in 9 years. The Giants would cut him loose in 1992. 1993. He would sign as a free agent with the Athletics, but before the season, or at the very beginning of the season, I should say, the Athletics cut him. He signs with the Toronto Blue Jays, and after the 1994 season, signs with the Chicago White Sox in 1995, granted free agency after that season. No taker, so he would call it a career as a player there. But he had a very lengthy career as a coach and is now in upper management. Dave Rigetti became the pitching coach for the Giants starting in 2000 and would continue to be a pitching coach for many, many years. Was part of the coaching staff that helped guys like Tim Lincecum, Madison Bumgarner, all those Giants pitchers of the World Series teams in 2010, 12, and 14. And he was not only so successful there that he would continue to be a pitching coach for, 18 years. He finally, at the end of the 2017 season, moved into the Giants front office. So there's the tale of not only Dave Rigetti, but an interesting cross story with Father Leo Rigetti and San Jose City College teammate Dave Steeb. And I thought it was so interesting that the Texas Rangers scout, who's giving advice to Dave Rigetti, was giving the exact same advice to Dave Steeb. And I have to wonder, had Steeb listened to the scout and switched to pitching, would the Texas Rangers have drafted Dave Steeb and not the Toronto Blue Jays? That's just one of those great what-if stories from the era. Now let's take a look from the 89 Bowman packs. Bob McClure, and every time I see Bob McClure, I think of two things. First, I think of the Simpsons character Troy McClure. Hi, I'm Troy McClure. You may remember me from other films like Get Confident, Stupid. Yes, the late, great Phil Hartman voicing Troy McClure in those educational films. That was great. But I also think of Bob McClure with one of the best mustaches in Major League Baseball in the 1980s. Bob McClure, born in Oakland, California. He's still a coach, by the way, but let's talk about his playing days. Again, born in Oakland, played at Terra Nova High School in Pacifica, California. Originally drafted by the Dodgers in 1973. Did not sign with them, eventually signed with the Kansas City Royals, who picked him up in the secondary phase of the 73 draft, also a third-round selection. Now, at the beginning of his career, he was a starting pitcher and worked his way up very quickly through the Royals organization. August 1975 makes his major league debut and splits time over the next year and a half with Kansas City and their AAA Farm Club in Omaha. Now, he was part of a notable trade as he was the player to be named later in the Darryl Porter trade. This was in December of 76. The Royals get Darryl Porter and Jim Colburn in exchange for Jamie Quirk, Jim Wolford, and McClure. And that worked out rather well for McClure and the Brewers as he led the Brewers in saves in 1978 and 1980. Sat out most of the 1981 season with arm injuries, but then got moved to the starting rotation in 1982. Not only because he's fully healed from the arm injuries, but also because you've got Raleigh Fingers now as the closer. Now, he would also, McClure, have an indelible impression on the 1982 Brewers season in the playoffs. He made five appearances, had saves in games 4 and 5, but also took two losses, including the blown save decision in game 7. Of course, the Cardinals winning that series in 7 games. Now, he would be part of the starting rotation in 1983 and 84, and eventually returns back to the bullpen in 1985. He gets traded to the Montreal Expos midway through the 1986 season. Had a couple of productive seasons actually with the Expos. Eventually would go on to play for the New York Mets. Later the California Angels, which is what he is pictured here with the 89 Bowman card. Had trouble early in the 1991 season. Was released by the Angels. Gets picked up by the St. Louis Cardinals, would continue to play for them through 1992, signs with the expansion Marlins in 1993, but is released early in the 1993 season, and his playing career was done. But that would start a very lengthy coaching career. He worked as a pitching coach for the Colorado Rockies starting in 1999 through 2005. Also was part of a coaching staff at their AAA Farm Club then in Colorado Springs. Later would be the pitching coach in Kansas City, followed by pitching coach stints with the Boston Red Sox and the Philadelphia Phillies. He is now the bullpen coach for the Minnesota Twins, a job he took just prior to the beginning of the 2020 season. Finally, we've got Jody Reed. And boy, Jody Reed is just an interesting story. Lots of interesting stories. And first of all, Jody Reed is one of the more unheralded young ball players to come out of the Tampa, Florida region. And you think of all the great ball players, you know, Dwight Gooden and Wade Boggs, you know, there's just so many, Fred McGriff, Gary Sheffield, so many guys who were, you know, born in the late 50s or early 60s and came up through Tampa and made it to the major leagues. Jody Reed is often overlooked. And it's unfortunate because he played 11 seasons in the big leagues, was a utility infielder, but really had his strengths at second base, hit for average, especially in his early years in Boston, defensively pretty solid at second or short. Again, you know, better at second than short. But there were a couple of mistakes in his career that will always come back to haunt him. And maybe this is what brings down the legend of Jody Reed, if you will. He was born in Tampa, attended Brandon High School. That was the arch rival high school of my high school. Brandon High School in Brandon, Florida, would play college ball at Manatee Community College before joining Florida State University. Texas Rangers would draft him in the third round of the 1982 January draft. He did not sign. Same thing in the second round of the 83 June secondary draft, did not sign. So also drafted by the San Francisco Giants. In fact, he was actually drafted, I got these dates out of order here. Texas Rangers third round in 82, San Francisco Giants first round in 82, and then Texas Rangers second round of the June secondary 1983. Didn't sign with all three of those teams. Now, he eventually gets drafted in the eighth round by the Red Sox in 1984. He signs, starts in their Florida State League, works his way up through their organization, makes his major league debut in September of 1987, gets a little bit of experience there, appearing in nine games, does rather well, and is very quickly elevated to the role of starting shortstop, starting in 1988. As I said, he would move over to second base by 1989, was very successful there, led the American League with 45 doubles in 1990, also had more than 40 doubles in the 1989 and 91 season, was part of two division champion teams with the Red Sox in 1988 and 1990. Now, while the Red Sox are looking to bring up somebody younger at second base, the Colorado Rockies, through a deal arranged with the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Rockies draft Jody Reed in the expansion draft. And the Dodgers make a deal, hey, you take Reed, we will then trade young pitcher but often injured Rudy Saenz, and we'll take Jody Reed off your hands. So that's exactly what happens. So in 1993, Jody Reed goes to the Dodgers and has a nice season there. Plays 132 games, hits 276, and you're thinking, all right, he's got a pretty lengthy career here. But then comes one of the most remarkable stories that I have ever read. Jody Reed was offered by the Dodgers a three-year, $7.8 million contract extension. So you're thinking, all right, pretty good deal here. Well, apparently he gets some bad advice from his agent slash longtime friend. That's never really a good combination. And the agent says, all right, you can get $7.8 million over 3 years with the Dodgers. Or, hey, you're a free agent. Why don't you test the waters? And there was a good reason for Jody Reed to test the waters, because comparable players, such as Bobby Thompson over with the Giants, they were about to strike it rich, you know, get some, you know, pretty good deals during the winter of 1993-94. So Jody Reed goes, yep, I'm going to turn this down. There are other stories that he didn't like his shortstop partner, Jose Offerman. A lot of Dodgers didn't like Jose Offerman. For Jody Reed, it was because Offerman's throws were often so late and off the target Reed was afraid of getting clocked by one of these bad throws by Offerman and, you know, maybe getting injured in the double play process. But there were some issues with the Dodgers. Reed thought it'd be worth testing the waters. If Thompson's going to get a good deal from somebody, then maybe I will too. Well, Thompson did get a good deal, and it wasn't from, you know, or it wasn't a benefit to Jody Reed. Here's how the dominoes fall, and this is amazing. So Jody Reed, despite this incredibly wealthy offer from the Dodgers, again, 3 years, $7.8 million, decides to walk away. He's going to apply for free agency. So he files as a free agent. The Dodgers then turn their attention to Bobby Thompson. Well, the Giants ain't going to let Bobby Thompson go to the Dodgers, so they very quickly sign him to a lucrative deal very much in the same ballpark as Jody Reed. Well, Reed has already signaled to the Dodgers, I have no interest in playing for you. So the Dodgers now need a second baseman. So they look around and they go, aha, let's get this Delino DeShields guy from the Montreal Expos. That will be our replacement for Jody Reed. The Expos, no fool to the fact that the Dodgers are in a pickle here, because now they can't get Thompson. Reed has no desire to play in L.A. They decide to hold out for ransom the player to be exchanged for Delino DeShields. And who would that player be? Yes, future Hall of Fame pitcher Pedro Martinez. So the Dodgers are going to need to fill that hole at second base, give up on Pedro. They get Delino DeShields, who was good but not great, and basically run out of Los Angeles after 3 years. But wait, it gets better. What happens to Jody Reed? Well, he walks away from the money from the Dodgers. He can't get the money that the Giants offer a guy like Bobby Thompson. So his last option is to sign a free agent contract with the Milwaukee Brewers. A one-year contract worth $350,000 plus incentives, where if he got enough plate appearances, it would push it up a little closer to $1 million. Of course, 1994, you have the strike. So I don't believe he hit those incentives. He hit .271 with the Brewers in 1994 in 108 games. And Jody Reed would have to live with the rest of his life for the fact that he turned down $7.8 million. So that's just over $2.6 million a year for 3 years with an organization like the Dodgers to play for this bumbling Milwaukee Brewers team for a fraction of what he would have gotten. And then he's got to start the whole free agent romancing again. He signs on with the San Diego Padres in April 1995, has a decent couple of seasons there, gets traded to the Detroit Tigers in March of 1997, appears in only 52 games, hitting a whopping .196. And that would do it for his playing career. So what could have been the launching point for another lucrative contract, it turns out his career ends with a whimper in Detroit. Now, Reed would manage the Gulf Coast Yankees in 2007 and 2008, was later the minor league defensive coordinators for the Yankees organization, and the interim manager for the Staten Island Yankees in 2010. He would come back to the Dodgers, however, manager of the Arizona League Dodgers, coordinator of instruction for the Dodgers Camelback Ranch facility in Glendale, Arizona, and would also be an infielder or an infield coordinator for the Dodgers minor league system and a manager for the AA Chattanooga Lookouts in 2013. But what an interesting weave of stories there, huh? Boy, Jody Reed comes up, you know, does well in Boston, gets shifted over to the Dodgers around the expansion draft, does well in LA for 1 year, turns down that 3-year contract, can't get the contract that Bobby Thompson gets. Dodgers can't get Bobby Thompson. So they trade Pedro Martinez for Delino DeShields, who flames out in LA. And poor Jody Reed ends up sucking up a terrible contract in Milwaukee and then bouncing around between San Diego and Detroit final years of his career. It's simply amazing. Well, that's an amazing turkey trade. Some amazing stories as well. And I think that kind of wraps up our fun discussion about some of the Thanksgiving turkeys that we have here. And again, A set may be labeled a turkey, or some people may not like particular sets. Everyone poo-poos 91 Fleer, or 91 Score, or 88 Donruss. You can stretch it out beyond junk wax. You know, 82 Fleers is a clunker, 81 Donruss is a clunker. A lot of the baseball cards released in the late 90s were not that good. But if you have that emotional attachment to it, it's not a turkey to you. It's the gravy, baby. And you can still enjoy some of these turkey sets, regardless of what others think. But like I always caution with any junk wax era card, don't bet the farm on the value coming back in any of these. But I think you already know that by now. Don't forget to join me for the next Wax Ecstatic coming your way Friday, December 4th, as we will take a look back at the classic and legendary 1963 Fleer set, that first big public middle finger that Fleer gave Topps, and then Topps dropped the hammer on that finger, and it hurt Fleer for a while, but Fleer would eventually get their revenge on Topps, starting in 1980 with the United States Supreme Court case. So we'll talk more about that. Plus, whatever else is on your mind, don't forget Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter is our channel, open 24/7. Always looking forward to your questions, comments, thoughts about the shows, the players we talk about, the cards we discuss as well. And don't forget, cardboard donations, welcome. Email me, mattsalmonsays@gmail.com, or you can comment on the Twitter feed as well. And don't forget, cash donations, always appreciated, always 100% come back to the program. You can make those at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Have a happy and safe Thanksgiving holiday. Please be smart. All right. Don't have those large gatherings, folks. This COVID thing's rearing its ugly head once again, and rather harshly too. Wash those hands, social distance. Please wear your mask. Not only so that you can join us for our next podcast, but so you're not hooked up to a ventilator for Christmas. And even though this Thanksgiving is very unusual, with all the vaccine news that's coming out, hopefully we can have a normal Thanksgiving holiday in 2021. But it starts by being smart this Thanksgiving. Again, wash those hands, social distance, wear those masks, and take care of one another. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. We will see you next time. And as God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.